was an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. Hey, Rachel.
Hi, Stephen.
We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers. We host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today on the phone is Eric Blanc. Eric, are you there?
I am. Great to be on.
Hey, good to hear your voice. So Eric is now a famous author, but Eric, tell us about what you were doing before you became a published author. Tell us about your teaching background and experience.
Yeah, so I grew up in a labor family and a teaching family, and I, after going to school, I was a teacher in different parts of the East Bay of California for 6 years,
yeah,
high school mostly. And that experience, like so many other educators across the country, ended up leading me to conclude that it was very hard to survive in the Bay Area or almost any other big city on educator wages. I ended up going to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that time that I was able to go cover the strike wave that has kind of popped off in the last few years.
Gotcha. Okay, so tell us some more about what led you to your book, Red State Revolt, and why you wanted to write about teacher strikes.
Well, I mean, the big story is that the strike wave that has kind of erupted since West Virginia in 2018 has brought back the weapon of the strike, really, to the U.S. political arena in a way that hasn't been seen for decades. You know, in 2018, you saw more workers on strike than we've seen since the strike than any other year in the history of this country. So
yes,
it seemed to me at the time pretty self-evident that this was a really big deal. And I think that for anyone who follows education or even labor, it's pretty uncontroversial that this was a game changer as far as the fight around public education, and then also just more broadly, what it's going to take to rebuild the fighting labor movement. So when West Virginia kind of erupted to the surprise of a lot of people, I didn't really hesitate to go there and to try to, you know, meet the local organizers and to use whatever platform I could to kind of lift up their stories and their organizing.
So as you mentioned, there have been a number of strikes, and I'm wondering how your knowledge of teacher organizing around the country has grown since you published your book. And maybe you can tell our listeners of other successful actions that have occurred since the book came out.
Right. So for listeners who don't know in detail about the teachers' strike wave, in some ways the first strike, it goes back years earlier, which is 2012 in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And that really kind of set the stage for a type of social justice unionism, a type of unionism that's more militant, that's oriented towards building, you know, ties with the community, with parents, fighting for racial justice, social justice, and using the strike to win. And that model then generalized more broadly in 2018 and the kind of a wave of red state strikes in Arizona, Kentucky, West Virginia, and then more recently, in just this last year in 2019, you had major strikes spread to, you know, quote unquote blue cities or blue states. Places like Los Angeles had a massive strike, Oakland had a massive strike, Chicago struck again. And so, you know, one of the fascinating things about the whole experience has been to look at the different ways educators have organized, because in some of these red states, strikes were illegal, unions were very weak, they had to rely more on social media, and so the strikes had a more volcanic, less organized quality, which had its strengths and limitations. Whereas in a place like Los Angeles, you know, they were building up through the union for almost 4 years mm-hmm. to their strike. And so the different ways that teachers have to fight depending on the political context in some ways, I think, is a, you know, it's something that I hadn't really fully imagined before, and it's really been, I think, an interesting aspect of the struggle so far.
And in your research, what are some common workplace issues that educators across the country are rallying around, like very specifically issues with their workload, and also common enemies and obstacles they're facing nationwide?
Yeah, that's a good question. When the West Virginia strike happened and some of the red state strikes, there was a not very helpful discourse in the corporate media about, well, this is just about pay and it's just against Republican government.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for those of us who've been teachers for a while or involved in the education movement, we know that's just not the case, that in fact the Democratic Party in many places has been even worse than the Republicans in pushing austerity and pushing privatization. You know, you have more charter schools and under Democratic administrations and Democratic cities and states than you do in Republican states, actually. So this idea that it was just a question of Republicans and just about pay was not at all the case. One of the, you know, really underlying issues in all of the different states where there's been strikes is that it's just been so hard to do your job as an educator over the last 10 years in particular since the Great Recession, but, you know, in some ways going back 20, 30, because there's been this wave of underfunding. So just students don't have basic things they need, like classes that are under 40 students, textbooks that are up to date. But then what this in turn leads to is a scapegoating of teachers under, you know, what is a high-stakes testing regime. And so this is what you have then is you have more and more teachers faced with harder conditions because they don't have resources and then being punished because the test scores of their students don't match up to, you know, relatively arbitrary criteria. So what that's meant is just the creativity and the autonomy and the joy and the passion of educators has just been under attack because everywhere it's just been so hard to do our jobs for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways that's the underlying grievance all across the board is people, you know, people want their students to be able to learn, and they, you know, they really do truly love their students, and that's been made impossible by budget cuts and been made impossible by the over-testing regime. And, you know, that's a bipartisan policy across the board that now is being, you know, I think pretty significantly reversed, at least in the electoral promises that candidates are making. You know, we're winning the public argument, but the policy changes, I think, are still not quite there.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point for our listeners to understand, especially educators, that this this experience is being felt all over the country. This is not about lack of professionalism or ability, that this is something that has happened and slowly eroded over time to where it feels like this is normal, when in fact it's a disintegration, a slow
erosion. And it's a very conscious policy. You know, you see this in all across the world, and anytime there's a strong public sector, what you do is you underfund it, and then you make it you know, you put it in an artificial crisis, and then you say, well, the solution is the private sector. So, you know, they pushed charter schools, all sorts of privatization efforts, because they were able for a period to make it seem like that was the only solution to, you know, what they called the inherent, you know, inefficiencies of the public sector. But now I think people have seen that charter schools aren't a solution. Actually, even on their own criteria, test scores even worse, let alone, you know, actual learning. So the, you know, the tide is turning really back in our favor now, in large part because of these strikes.
Mm-hmm. So you did some research. You wrote your book, Red State Revolt. Highly recommend it to folks. What would you say are the big takeaways, at least so far, from the Red for Ed movement and what it means for the labor movement?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot. The first is the most obvious, I think, which is that if the labor movement's going to win and start reversing its, you know, pretty dramatic decline over the last decades, it has to bring back the strike as, you know, really our most powerful weapon. Mm-hmm. It was dropped consciously and then also, you know, under pressure from employers and the state, but there's just no way to build power sufficient to force employers, whether it's the public sector or the private sector, without the strike, or at least a credible strike threat. So that's, I think, in some ways the big story, which is that, you know, it's not just for education, but across the board, if you look at what it's going to take to win, we need to be able to withhold our labor collectively to force employers to listen to us. That's the first. The second, I would say, is that the way you build that power is by orienting towards activating rank and file workers. And, you know, and that's different than the way the labor movement oftentimes has behaved, particularly recently, where it's mostly backroom deals with, you know, politicians, and, you know, members are at best treated like funding sources. You know, you pay your dues. And the whether it's a strike or just any type of organizing, the power of our movement comes from involving, giving real power to workplace leaders, and all workers, you know, need to be able to feel like the movement is theirs, that the union is theirs. It's not something like a third party outside of their own efforts. You know, and then finally, I think the big lesson is that neither the Democratic Party establishment, at least, or the Republican Party are on the side of working class people. You know, they've been imposing these attacks, and the strikes have been, in the last year, primarily against Democratic leaders who made good campaign promises but then have implemented policies of austerity and privatization.
Yes.
So the question of building power at the workplace but then also building independent political power, one of the exciting things about this movement is it's also dovetailing with the resurgence in democratic socialism across the country. People like Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, are giving, I think, a political voice in the political electoral arena to the same types of issues that that you saw in the strikes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Labor Radio. We have Eric Blanc on the phone with us. And I just wanted to follow up on that a little bit. So I have heard this criticism a little bit. What do you say to folks who are critical of the Red for Ed movement, referring to it as mobilizing or trying to just take a shortcut rather than real deep organizing?
Well, you know, the Red for Ed movement is a pretty heterogeneous movement. So it looks different everywhere. You know, in some ways it's a hashtag, right? It's not, yes, like there's one Red for Ed movement. So the Los Angeles strike, for instance, in 2019, was the most organized, the most sort of classically focused, strategic, well-organized strike, I think, in recent memory. And it's really worth studying. And so it's definitely not the case that all across the board the Red Thread movement has been a manifestation of mobilizing, which for listeners who maybe don't know what that means in the terminology, I think you're referencing it too. You know, Jay McAlevey is an author who's sort of popularized this language, and I think it's a good one, which is mobilizing is you just sort of ask your existing base to come out to actions, but you're not developing new organizers in the process. You're not really building new leadership who can then in turn go organize larger groups. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there's some aspect of some of these movements that, you know, they weren't fully oriented towards organizing in a way that could have built more sustained power. So I think one of the limitations of the Red State strike is not that the leaders the rank and file leaders that initiated these strikes didn't want to organize, but it was just, you know, they had very small groups of rank and file militants who created these Facebook pages and often had to go up against their own union leaders, and so they didn't, you know, have the time and space just within a couple weeks or a couple months to build and sustain the types of structures that are ultimately necessary for, you know, long-standing power. I don't see any way around that in those states where the unions are weak. It just takes longer to build up a strong union. It takes building caucuses to win leadership in these unions and transform them. And so I do think that ultimately the model that we would want to look towards generalizing is something more like the Los Angeles model, which is part mm-hmm. of the Red Thread movement. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in places where you don't have strong unions, you don't have the right to strike, and you don't have collective bargaining, I think we should expect that there's going to be, you know, more manifestations of this more volcanic type upsurge. And that's good. We want people to fight back. And then out of that process, build strong organization.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
So, Eric, you are a surrogate for Bernie Sanders, and I'd like you to talk about what makes Bernie stand out from the other candidates in this primary, so much so that you decided to get involved in his campaign.
Yeah, well, it goes to a bit about what we were talking about before, which is, you know, how do you win? Most people in this country at this point, you know, understand that there's a lot of problems with climate change, whether it's public education, whether it's economic inequality. And I think that what Bernie has articulated and that he understands is a similar type of vision of change and understanding of power that the strike wave and the Red for Ed movement has put forward, which is to say that the only way you win significant change on behalf of the majority of people, whether it's educators or whether it's really any part of the working class, is through independent organization against the billionaires and the politicians mm-hmm. that they've bought off. And that's a really different vision of how you make change than, I mean, clearly the corporate Democrats, but even, you know, even more progressives like Elizabeth Warren, who I think, you know, have a lot of good policies, but don't really orient and come out of this more working class, popular social movement type orientation. And so when Bernie says that he's going to be an organizer in chief when elected, what that means is that the way we're going to win the promises that, to be honest, a lot of Democrats are making now. Bernie Sanders' platform around education is by far the best. People should check it out. It's called the Thurgood Marshall Plan for Public Education. It's fantastic. It talks about a moratorium on charters, massive refunding. And so we can talk about the details of that. But ultimately, what it's going to take to win that is not just electing somebody, but is empowering working people everywhere across the country to get organized to fight back. And, you know, that's what I saw Bernie doing. I became excited about the Bernie campaign in large part because I was out there in all of these strikes. And just over and over again, Bernie Sanders was the candidate who was raising their issues, who was not just, you know, coming up to support them when he was on the electoral trail, because a lot of this was well before the primaries, but was getting his own supporters to come out and support the strikes, you know, even that more recently, using his like massive email and Twitter and social media feed, you know, not just to talk about how he's supporting them, but actually asking his supporters to go out to the strikes and the picket lines. Mm. And so that really shows me, I think, what convinced me that ultimately he's the person
who is going to consistently be on the side of educators in our fight, and really, you know, I think unions and working class people more generally.
Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you brought up the Thurgood Marshall Plan for Education, and I'm wondering if you could speak a little more directly to that, how that impacts educators and students.
Right. So if you think about all of the demands that the Red for Ed movement has raised over the last almost 3 years now, some of very central issues just keep on coming up again and again. And what the Thurgood Marshall Plan does is it really crystallizes all of the major demands of the movement and puts in one big package. And, you know, to highlight some of them, you have, whether it's the question of pay, the proposal proposes a minimum $60,000 starting salary for educators nationally. It is a question of privatization. So if you talk about, you know, the demands that we've seen for rolling back charters and for putting, you know, really the funding into a serious public education program, that is in the Thurgood Marshall Plan. It's calling, supporting the NAACP's call for a moratorium on further funding for charter schools. You have an increase in Title I funding so that communities of color and in particular low-income communities can get the necessary funds they need, so you can start reversing the really dramatic racial resegregation of our school system. And across the board, really, there's no demand that has been raised by the public education movement over the last 2 years that is not incorporated into the Thurgood Marshall Plan. So it's very exciting, and I think it's one of the reasons why you see so many educators supporting Bernie right now. Some of your listeners might already know, but actually the number one workforce, or the number one profession of anybody supporting Bernie when it comes to the donors, is teachers, right? And that's significant. It means that teachers have seen Bernie out there, and they see that the Thurgood Marshall Plan in particular is really their political platform. And I think it's, you know, up to us to fight for that in the streets, but also at the ballot box.
Yes, and I just want to also tell our listeners a couple more things that I remember off the top of my head, that there's more funding for special education and meals for students, breakfast, lunch, and dinner provided. So really enhancing the wraparound services that are needed for our students.
I would really recommend people check out all the details. There's a lot of it in there, so it's hard to go into all the details. But as you mentioned, one of the things that the movement has brought up and that is a central part of the Thurgood Marshall Plan is the fight for, you know, what we call community schools, which is, as you mentioned, really creating schools that provide the services that students need to thrive, so that schools can be sort of the center of a, you know, really multifaceted community institution that can be a home and a community center for working class students. And so I think it's really exciting. We've seen some examples of that already in practice in Los Angeles, but, you know, we need more funds to generalize that model across the country.
Eric, how do you see some of Bernie's other proposals, such as the Green New Deal, College for All, Medicare for All, Workplace Democracy, Housing for All? I mean, he has so many. How do you see those, some of those at least, intersecting with education issues? Why are these policies, or why should they at least be important to educators?
Yeah, you know, none of the different issues that we're talking about, whether it's fight against racism, patriarchy, whether it's looming climate disaster, economic inequality, or public education, none of these things can ultimately be separated from each other because they're all rooted in the basic fact that billionaires control our political government and the economy, and that the only way you're going to win on any of these things is by building a movement from below of working class people. So to go into the details of what that means, for instance, think about what it will take to really pass a Green New Deal, and what does that, you know, require. Part of that is providing alternatives for non-carbon emitting industries. And so there's a lot of talk, which I think is good, about green collar work, pink collar work. And so that means massively building up our public education sector, healthcare sector in a public way so that you can have millions of people employed in sectors that create no harm and no carbon emissions. And I think that ultimately then what you're seeing is that the fight for more school funding is a fight, I think, for the Green New Deal, because that money also has to come from somewhere. And I think that the way we're going to fund the Green New Deal and the way that we're going to fund public education is the same, which is that we have to go over these same billionaires that have got tax cut after tax cut, same corporations that have got decades of tax cuts. And the funding has to come from that source. You're not going to have funds for public education. You're not going to have funds for the Green New Deal. You're not going to have funds for Medicare for All without attacking that source. So unless we're to find a way to be able to connect these struggles together, mm-hmm. I think that ultimately none of our struggles are going to be able to succeed.
Great. The weekend of this weekend coming up, January 17th through 19th, is an Educators for Bernie weekend of action. Could you quickly describe the organizing effort to get educators involved in the campaign?
Yeah. We had a really exciting National Educators for Bernie call just yesterday, actually. We had over 400 educators from all across the country call in to hear about what they could do to elect Bernie and then also win what we call the political revolution, the types of transformation I was talking about. And the weekend of action is the next big step. We are doing mapping parties all across the country, which means that educators are going to come together, all cities and towns all across the country, to map out their school sites, their coworkers, and to make a list really of who they need to talk to, who we need to convince them that Bernie Sanders is the best candidate to beat Trump and to win the types of schools that we need. And so, yeah, I would really encourage educators all across the country to, just go BernieSanders.com. You can find out all of the upcoming events there. You can look on Facebook for Educators for Bernie. We have a new Facebook group. That's probably the best way to get plugged in. And, yeah, we really, if there's anybody out there listening, now's the time. The country is at a crossroads, and the actions that organizers and people who aren't yet organizers take right now is going to be pivotal for what you see in the next years and decades. So for everyone who's out there and who's, progressive and who supports Bernie but isn't yet, fully involved, now's the time. We just have a few more weeks before Iowa and before the primary goes into high gear. And I think what's exciting about the Red for Ed movement is raised expectations of educators. People feel like they do have the power to win. They've been on strike, they've seen strikes succeed. And so that means that the kind of the type of really ambitious vision that Bernie has projected meshes with our lived experience, because we've seen, you can fight and win. We don't just have to take what's going around. So yeah, Educators for Bernie National Weekend of Action is this coming weekend. Look for a mapping party near you. You can just go to BernieSanders.com or Educators for Bernie Facebook group on social media.
Well, we have very little time left, but I am curious about what you're going to be up to. I mean, I'm assuming for the next few months it's going to be working with the Bernie campaign, but maybe some other things you have in the future, another book maybe?
A lot of it really depends on what happens in the struggle. It's actually been nice for me to take off my writer hat the last few weeks and really dig into the organizing around Bernie. But I would love to be able to write more about the struggles that workers across the country are going to do over this next year, because unless you have that type of bottom-up resurgence continuing, you can elect politicians, but there's only so much they can do. So mm-hmm. I really hope that I can write another book about the even bigger struggles that are going to come.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It was a real
pleasure.
Thanks,
Eric.
Thanks to our engineer, Jeff, and thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen, co-host extraordinaire. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio, and please tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show. Good night.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
I'm Shahid Hamid, KBOO board member. Join the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Radio as we pay homage to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the 35th anniversary of Keep Alive the Dream, Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center. This year, we will be joined by international opera star Angela Brown and straight from America's Got Talent, Danielle Damon. That's Monday, January the 20th, from 11 to 6:30 p.m. at the Highland Christian Center at 7600 Northeast Gleason. Or listen live on KBOO Radio or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. A Billy fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Cell on a block, he hanged himself at dawn with a note stuck to the bunkhead.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution.